How's it going? And welcome to the podcast. Keeping it eclectic with today's guest, Sean Flanagan from Element and Films, outstanding director, writer, producer, and I call him a visionary filmmaker. So without further ado, let's get to it. Talk movies with Sean Flanagan. I've described Sean Flanagan as a visionary filmmaker. How does that work for you?
I think that feels great. Thank you, David.
I'm making you blush.
No, absolutely. I'm a shy dude, man. It's been a long road. It's been a very long road. And now at 55, I'm able to look back and see how far I've come. And I'm very proud of, you know, what has been done and the people that I've surrounded myself with. And it just, it's an amazing process making movies with actors and just writing something and coming up with it.
Is it true that you got the movie bug after being an extra in The Right Stuff, that movie that won, I think, 4 Academy Awards and pretty good cast too, Ed Harris, Dennis Quaid, Sam Shepard, Barbara Hershey? That was your inspiration?
Yeah, I was 18 years old. I was working in a donut shop. I was scrubbing the floors in this donut shop at Eastridge Mall. And I heard over the radio, oh, we need extras for a new movie called The Right Stuff. You don't get paid, but we'll feed you. And I had never done anything. And I says, wow, I would really like to do that. And so I volunteered and I got picked. And we were at the Cow Palace and we were in the grandstands. And down below, that's where all the camera crew was. And it was like a barbecue that was like a staging barbecue in the movie. And then these Lincoln Continentals pulled in with all the astronauts, which is the actors that you had mentioned. And I was up in the stands and I was far away. And I turned to this lady next to me and I go, wow, this is really cool. I want to do this for the rest of my life. And I did a lot of extra work after that. But to me, it was very valuable to be around, you know, the sets and see how things are done.
So that was an aha moment for you then?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now talk about this project, Sean, that is new to the folks on Amazon Prime. In fact, I watched it a couple weeks ago. It's fantastic, called The Unwilling. And it's new to the audience, but certainly not new to you. It's been something in the works for a long time.
Yeah, some friends of mine and I, we wanted to make another movie. And in 2004, we were going to make this short film. And then we found, you know, with all this work that was happening, we said, hey, you know, man, this is a lot of work. Why don't we just make a full-length movie? And so Tony Santucci, my producing partner, who also starred in the film, he goes, okay, I'm up for that. And so we started, I had a new camera. It was a Canon XL2 with mini DV tapes. And we just went to town and, you know, started filming this thing. So it took much longer than we thought because there was no real set budget. And which is not a very good thing to do when you're making a movie because there's always that, the window is always open to just keep filming, you know, because you got to do whatever it takes. It's better to have some sort of a goal and an outline and go with that. And so we shot a part of 2000, I think it was 2005 and part of 2006. We did a lot of weekend stuff. And then the film went to the, I made the mistake of actually submitting a work in progress to the Santa Cruz Film Festival. And what happens when you submit a work in progress, when you get accepted, you now have to rush to get your movie finished to get into this film festival. And if any young filmmaker out there is listening, never, ever, ever do that. Because when you rush to get that film done for the sake of a film festival, it's just not a good thing to do. And I know a lot of filmmakers who have done that, but it's just best to wait. It's best to wait, get the film done exactly the way you want it, and then stop and look around and see what kind of festivals you're right for, and then resubmit. So, on that note, the movie went to the Santa Cruz Film Festival, and I really wasn't pleased with the outcome of the film.
And this is 2005?
This was 2000, I can't remember the exact date. It may 2005 or 6, maybe. I think on IMDb we're as listed as 2007, but I think the festival was maybe 2006. So I says, whoa, I says, I need to do some re-editing. And so I spent 6 months re-editing the film after the master that we used for Santa Cruz. And I was editing on a PC and the computer crashed and I lost the whole re-edit of the movie. So I lost the film. And so all we had, I had about somewhere between 45 and 50 hours of footage on these mini DV tapes, and they were all in a shoebox. And that shoebox sat for 10 years. And I says, one of these days I want to re-edit that movie. And a couple of times I did some tests, because through those 10 years, the editing software had improved. The editing software had improved on a number of different levels. But during that improvement for high definition footage, I don't know what they did, but they also allowed for the older footage to look pristine through this editing software. And I know for a fact that it was the software that did this, because over those 10 years, I had done different tests to see if I could, you know, if now was the time for me to restart, to start re-editing the movie. And a lot of those tests, they didn't work right, because the, you know, the aspect ratio of standard definition mini DV, even though I shot, so the aspect ratio was different. So over the years, Final Cut Pro says, hey, look, these are all the people in the past that have shot, whether it's a Polaroid camera or a mini DV or VHS or Hi-8 or whatever it was, they've done something to now accommodate this footage. So when you look at the Unwilling, it really looks like old school film, but it's amazing how the mini DV footage actually held up in the aspect ratio of a high definition frame, because the movie was never shot in high definition. But the one thing that I think I did right with the camera is that when you're shooting mini DV on that particular camera, you can shoot 24p or 60p, but they also have this thing called the, I think it's the 3-2-2 pull down or the 4-2-2 pull down, and it allows the film to present itself better if you should go to a theater. So I think that, you know, a big screen. So I think that maybe that had something to do with the movie actually holding up 10 years later in high definition. So it was wonderful. And then, you know, so I edited after 10 years, pulled all the footage out of the shoebox. I thought I was going to edit for 6 months or a year. Turns out I was editing for 2 more years. And then I think it was the day I finished, 2 weeks later, I got a distributor and they got it up on Amazon.
It's pretty cool. Tell the audience about the story. Why should they watch it?
So, you know, I love making suspense thrillers. When you're a low, no budget filmmaker, often you're forced to write things that you know that you can shoot. Obviously, I can't film, you know, big scenes like, you know, Die Hard at an airport. It's just not going to happen. So whatever I write, we have to be able to shoot. We can always shoot in darkness. We can always shoot in the mountains. You know, certain friends, they have, you know, like Tony had a wonderful location in San Francisco. That was, you know, you could literally see AT&T Park from Petrero Hill. So we did a lot of stuff up there. He had a fire escape, which was used in the movie. So we decided to make this movie about a hitman. It was right around this time that my mother had passed away. And, for the last year of her life, she was always, you know, talking about guardian angels. So I happened to incorporate the theme of guardian angels into the movie, because I wanted to make sure that the guy that was a hitman, he finds out, you know, he discovers that what he's doing is wrong and he wants to sort of redeem himself, and he goes to a church and a confession box, and it reminds him of when he was young and his mother always said, hey, your guardian angels will be with you. So it's got a really good sort of backstory, and there's sort of a good message there that tells people that, there's a lot of bad things in life, but there's some good in life happening as well. I try to do that in a lot of my films, like Consequences of Violence. So wherever there's action, there's always the flip side to, you know, those actions.
What were the movie role models for you when you watch one on the screen and say, God, I want to make something like that?
Well, you know, movies have changed now, but back in the 80s, for me, it was all action films. Unfortunately, I didn't really start discovering Miramax style films until later in life because action films were so motivating to me because I was into, you know, in the 80s, it was with the discovery of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone's. It was the real beginning of muscles in the movies. And so, you know, Rambo and Commando and all those movies, they had an impact on me because it really made me, I don't know what it did. I'm sure it wasn't Orson Welles or Alfred Hitchcock type movie making. But later on, I started to, with the popularity of the San Jose CineQuest Film Festival, I started attending more film festivals. I started taking my writing a little bit more serious and my character development. But it was those movies that sort of shaped me. And, you know, you had asked me earlier about that aha moment. And I will tell you, and I think it was yesterday, I don't know if it was 33 years or something like that. 30, 40, 50. Yeah, I can't remember how many years ago, but that was the Rocky III anniversary. I was with my girlfriend. I was 18, and she goes, "Oh, let's go to a movie." And remember in those days when you pulled out the newspaper to see, you know, to figure out what movie you wanted to see?
Exactly.
And we're looking through this newspaper. She goes, "Oh, let's see this movie right here." I go, "I don't want to see a boxing movie." I go, "I want to see," and I'm really picky about the movies I see. And she talked me into seeing this movie called Rocky III. That movie changed my life. Every single day after that movie to the person I am right now in front of you,
Why is that?
that movie, I don't know what it was. I think it was because I had never seen any Rocky prior to that. Rocky III was the first Rocky movie I saw. I did not see Rocky II or Rocky I. And I really didn't know who Sylvester Stallone was until Rocky III. So when you want to be a filmmaker, it's really, really difficult to be a filmmaker or an actor. And so you have to be prepared to go the distance. And so Rocky III was the metaphor for going the distance. And when you hear the story of Rock Stallone, what he went through just to get the first Rocky made, because I backtrack and I started over and I saw the first movie and really started to discover who this guy was. To me, it was an amazing story. Truly amazing to be able to say, okay, you want to do this thing called film and acting, but are you ready? Because that journey is like preparing for a fight.
And nobody thought
And
he was any
so,
good.
what's that?
In the early years, nobody thought he was any good. You know, he couldn't get an agent,
Right.
and nobody wanted the movie. I mean, he was a nobody.
Right. And, you know, I guess this, you know, there's a lot of different stories, rags to riches, roaches to riches, but I guess he auditioned for the Robert Chartoff and Erwin Winkler. And they go, "Okay, we'll call you." And on his way out of the audition, he says, "Oh, by the way, I write." And how often do you hear that? Turns out it's Rocky. And I can't, David, I can't think of any movie that probably has changed more lives in this world to this day for the better than the Rocky franchise. Not, you know, you got Star Wars, The Godfather, you got all those movies, and they did what they did, but it was the Rocky franchise that made people want to be live their lives better, I think.
I heard
I
that
mean, I
there,
can't think.
Sean, I heard that people, a few guys wanted that movie, but they didn't want him in it. So they finally found, you know, some production company that would accept Sylvester Stallone as the actor as like a last resort because that's the only way they could get the movie. And that's how he became famous.
Right. So I guess they wanted Burt Reynolds or Ryan O'Neal at the time.
Yeah, exactly. You've accomplished a lot. I mean, I'm looking at some of the things that you've done. You've had several movies at the San Jose CineQuest Festival. You won the Low Budget Genius Award for your work on the friggin' Mafia movie, starring Richard Lynch. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so that low budget genius award, as they called it, was actually, it wasn't from CineQuest. It was actually from the Silver Street International Film Festival, which I don't think exists anymore. So we were actually invited, my producing partner and I, Dan Conley, we were invited to that film festival. And it was sort of late notice, and we weren't able to attend, but they still gave us the award, you know, for the film. But the movie, the friggin' Mafia movie, was actually written for Richard Lynch, because I had worked with Richard Lynch before with Sean and Patrick Donahue on a couple action films that we had made. So I made this, I wrote this. We were coming off this whole Blair Witch sort of style of movie making. And I said, oh, you know, this is cool, because when I saw Blair Witch, I go, oh my God, that's exactly what I've been doing since 1980, is going out and filming my friends with a camera, and it's sort of news style coverage, but with a story. And I, so after the Blair Witch came out, I spoofed it with the Bald Witch Project. And then we did this movie called the Frigga Mafia movie. I'm trying to think, was, and I can't keep up with these dates. I can't remember which one was first. So, but anyway, I wanted to do kind of a Spinal Tap type of things. And that's what we did. The Frigga Mafia movie was very similar to Spinal Tap. And I thought, wouldn't it be, you know, kind of a funny movie if a guy like Richard Lynch, this Hollywood kind of superstar, because that's what he was to me, he was a very fine actor, you know, comes to San Jose to work with these low-budget wannabe filmmakers. And, you know, it got, so he got accepted to the film festival. We had our world premiere there. Richard came up. And, you know, that was, it was quite a story.
What do you know now that you wish you knew back when you started?
Well, I think with anything, once you do something for long enough, you just build this experience of knowing what to do and what not to do. In the early days, there's so many experimental phases. And one thing that I wish I would have started doing many years back was be an editor. Because when you're filming, there's just so many things going on, and you're really not thinking like an editor. Well, now that I'm an editor, when I make a movie, I could say, when I'm filming it, I go, okay, am I really going to use this? Because if I'm questioning myself at all, I'm not even going to shoot it. So that's being an editor and a film. I mean, that just goes hand in hand. Same with screenwriting. If I sit down to write a script, I'm thinking to myself, okay, how would I film this? And if I filmed it, how would I edit it? And if I wasn't going to edit it, should I even be writing it? So those things all sort of fit hand in hand. The Friggin' Mafia movie, it was basically about somebody like me going through the frustrations of making a movie and never getting it made, because so many people around me talking about doing it and it just never happened in the early days. So I couldn't see anybody else than me actually being in the movie. So if I had that to do over again, I would not be in the movie. I would have just directed it, because, you know, you worked with me on Jimi Kendrick. You saw I was about ready to fall over a couple times because I was just doing so. And that's the way it was in the Frigga Mafia movie. When we filmed on the mountaintop of Mount Umminum, my friend Tim Halpin, who's a pilot, he flew his airplane, you know, back and forth past this tower, and Richard Lynch was on this tower firing at this airplane going back and forth. And by the time, you know, and there was no runway there. There was no runway. So Tim had to fly out of Watsonville, which is, you know, 40 miles south. So with radios that were working and sometimes not, he would say, okay, I'm just going to fly back and forth, and we just have to roll camera until we say, okay, we've got it. So by the time we wrapped that mountaintop day, we were driving down off the mountain. Whoever was driving, I had them pull over because I had to vomit.
Really? Oh, man.
Because it was such a crazy day. I mean, I had such a massive headache, you know, because it was like Richard Lynch was upset because there was no hot coffee. And you had to go through three gates to get to the mountaintop, and whoever had the coffee was late, and so they didn't get through the gate, so there was no coffee. And he was genuinely pissed off that there was no coffee, but he also used that to his advantage as an actor, because that's the way his character was supposed to be in the movie anyway. So if you see the behind the scenes footage, you think that he's like really pissed at me,
because he was.
But he's only like half pissed at me because. Of like staying in the character. It was he was a great actor.
I forget it. We were talking earlier in the week, the casting director that I referred you to check out, Matt Berry, and he mentioned that as an actor, whatever you're feeling, whatever you're experiencing, don't deny it and try to go into character. Bring that to the character and just live it out. It might be different than what you had going in.
That's right. And, you know, you leave yourself a little vulnerable, but as an actor, that's where you're supposed to be. You're on the hot seat, and whatever happens, happens.
Is there a common mistake that independent filmmakers experience? Something, you know, because of the software, anybody can grab a camera and, quote, make a movie. To me, the one thing that jumps out with independent films is the sound. You can have a great story. You can have it shot beautifully. The acting's fantastic. But if the sound sucks, it's so distracting to the audience, and I think you pretty much have wasted your time. So that's a small detail, but a massive detail.
You know what? And that goes back to what I was saying about the editing. You, sound is huge. And, you know, a lot of times filmmakers on the set, everybody's so concerned about the camera. You know, we got a great camera. We got a red camera. And so sometimes the sound guy is overlooked. You know, sometimes the people are in a hurry and the sound guy says, wait, you know, I'm working, let me uncoil my cables, or let me move closer to the actor. And a lot of times a filmmaker will cut that person off and say, no, we're going, we're rolling now. I don't care where you are. And that is a mistake, because when you're on location, camera is number one and sound is number two. That's just the way it works out. But I think that filmmakers need to remember that that sound needs to be, they need to make the time for the sound guy, just as, you know, as they do for the camera. And I see so many young filmmakers today, you're right, they set up and they have beautiful cinematography. And sometimes the acting is, well, that's another story, but but the sound, I'm looking at a $1 million image, and then the sound is, you know, it sounds like it's coming out of a coffee can. And I'm thinking, and plus it's, and then it's got 1 million views, or it's, I'm thinking, okay, well, why? You know, I mean, the sound is just terrible. But even more so, David, I think that young filmmakers today need to actually, a lot of people forget about production management. They're so concerned with, again, you know, a good DP in the camera, and that's number one, that's priority. And they do all these things, you know, to you know, locations, and but yet they forget about the production management. And when you have a good production manager, a production manager, you know, looks beyond the current situation and says, okay, are we ready for all the things that are about to hit us and that are unforeseen? For example, if you're on a country road and it's 100 degrees and you didn't bring bug spray and you've got one case of water and you're going to be there all day and not enough ice, and the actress shows up in her car, she has no place to change. You know, all those little things can help, you know, make your a project, you know, spiral out of control. And that's just to name a few. So production management is very, very important. A lot of people forget that.
Is that something that you weren't good at when you started?
Well, not really. I think I was always a production manager. I'm kind of naturally, you know, why are we here and is it going to work? And if not, let's not even go. But I turned into a production manager when I worked with the Donahues on four full-length movies that were action films. And there were so many details in the safety of these stunts, you know, taking a gas tank out of a car and replacing it with a fuel cell. You know, so there was a lot of details. So it was those four films with the Donahues that allowed me to look at a script, break it down, you know, highlight the props, the guns, the wardrobe, our locations. Do the locations know that we're going to be there? Sometimes you're going to film in a bar and you've said, okay, let's check off the bar. The bar's done. We know we're going to film there. And the bar calls you a day before you're about to film. And they go, yeah, we don't want you to film here. So do you have a backup plan? So, you know, you have to have those little backup plans. So those are, you know, the important thing is, you know, to keep the project, keep the company moving.
We're familiar with your most popular genres, the suspense, the thrillers. Is there something that is on your to-do list that you haven't tackled yet in terms of style?
I don't know. I do like suspense thrillers quite a bit. That's probably what I'll do for quite a long time. I did a little bit of reality TV. That was fun because it was real. But I do like suspense thrillers. I love actors. I don't think I'll ever be a guy that makes Marvel movies, Marvel style movies. My son, who is now acting, I'm trying to find something for him and make sure that it's the right thing because he wants to, he loves Tom Hardy, for example, or Mickey Rourke, old school Mickey Rourke, a lot of the great actors. And so that's what he wants to do. He doesn't want to just go out and be silly and funny and stupid. He's taking acting very seriously. So if I can help with that, I will. So I'm really looking forward to sort of making sure that he's where he needs to be without getting too distracted with other things that happen around movie making, if you know what I mean.
What do you have against dance movies and romantic comedies?
They just don't do anything for me. I don't know what it is. I love them, for example, I love the music. I don't know what it is. I do not like to watch dancing. I don't care for dancing at all. I don't know what it is, but I shouldn't say that it's like, I don't know. I'm very, like I said, I'm very, very particular about the movies I watch. And so if it's got to be a movie that's going to lend itself to, how I feel about maybe the next movie that I'm going to make. When I did the movie Whiskey Slide, and I'm going to answer your question. When I did the movie Whiskey Slide for a month, I was listening to 1930s radio, a lot of old radio. I was, and then once we wrapped, I didn't want to ever listen to it again, for the most part. But Flashdance, I have the soundtrack to Flashdance. I love the music in that film, but it doesn't mean that I'm want to watch somebody dance for very long. I appreciate what it takes to be a dancer. Staying Alive, I loved Staying Alive. Sylvester Stallone directed that. It didn't do very well. John Travolta is a good dancer. The very opening of that movie, he was dancing, and the opening credits were was very fast. And I was in a theater, and I remember seeing that the day it opened. And so Frank Stallone sang the song "Far From Over," which was the opening credits. That was awesome. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was because Stallone directed it and Frank, his brother, sang the song, which was a huge hit for a while. And then you got John Travolta, who's dancing, and he's ripped because Stallone put him on this diet nutrition thing. So there was a lot of other things that sort of factored into the dance, and it wasn't just about dance.
Right.
So
It didn't have to be a movie about dancing, but just a good story, and there happens to be a dancing theme in there.
yeah, like I've never seen Dirty Dancing. I've
Really?
never saw that movie. I never saw that movie. And I don't care about the song either.
That's a must-have, but you're not a sensitive guy. You're not in touch with your sensitive side.
Oh, that you're wrong.
Really?
You're absolutely wrong. Oh yeah. So what do you mean by sensitive?
You wouldn't watch like Notting Hill, Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts.
No, I'm not
I guess it'd be called a chick flick, right?
I enjoyed Mel Gibson doing Hamlet. That was awesome.
Okay.
I love The Hours. Philip Glass, talk about sensitive music, unbelievable music. I cry at the drop of a hat from stuff like that. But I'm not, I don't know if I'm really into romantic comedies too much. I don't even know if I can name a romantic comedy that I care about because they end up being a little cheesy if you're not careful. They're predictable. You've kind of seen it before.
Like a Hallmark movie, you know the ending after the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. I will tell you, my favorite love story movie of all time is Somewhere in Time with Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeve. Yeah, that's a movie that I can always revisit. But if you said, Sean, let's make a football movie or a basketball movie or a baseball movie, I love sports. I'd make a dance movie, but I guess I think, you know, I like Saturday Night Fever.
There you go. It's a classic.
The first one, the original one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it all depends on what the movie's about.
I'll take that as a no. There's no way. You're not going to do it. You're kind of like nodding. Yeah. Yeah. You're not going to do one.
Well, yeah, again, you know, I think it's all about, you know, what's it about? Who's dancing? How'd they get there? And why are they dancing? And, you know, I guess it's like Karate Kid was a huge success, but, you know, it's nothing like Rocky. You know, John Avildsen is the same director from the first Rocky movie. And Karate Kid was very, very successful. But, you know, after a while, I just, you know, it was the, I don't know what it is. That could be similar to dance in a way, a dance style movie.
What about Jimi Hendrix? That's a movie that you shot last year. I was lucky enough to be a part of it. Great story. Shot beautifully, and I think with the technology now, with being able to use drones and special effects, it looks amazing. Tell the audience about that movie, what it's about, and what lies ahead for it.
So Jimi Hendrix, I guess, you know, we could say that Jimi Hendrix falls in the category of experimental film. You know, a lot of the films I've done have been, you know, when you do a low budget film, like I said earlier, a lot of times you just write something that you know you can do. And so Jimi Hendrix was basically written for you guys. It was like, okay, here's an idea. Willie Rowland said he wanted to make a movie that was very, very similar to Route 66. He had an old classic car. And that's basically how it started. We said, okay, let's write a movie based on the old Route 66 TV show. And using this old car out in the middle of nowhere, and let's see what we come up with. And it was experimental, but it was a really good chance for everybody to do what they do, whether they're writing or directing or acting or shooting or editing. And I think it came out nicely. The cut that you saw, the cut that you last saw, you know, we were talking about movies that are never finished, completed, they're only abandoned, yeah. Right? And that's true, you know. When you have a good budget and you could say, okay, here's the money and here's what we're going to do, and then you can go out and do it, there's a really good chance that you'll edit the film, maybe you'll have like a test screening, and then you could hear what the audience has to say and you could, you know, make a few tweaks based on the test audience. So that's sort of what we did with Jimi Hendrix. You know, you saw sort of an early test screening, and I gave it to you and, you know, six or seven people. And based on people and how they reacted, even though I didn't give you a card with a pencil that said, what did you like about it or not like about it or wish that was different, I could tell that people were really not on fire over it. And it wasn't that they weren't on fire over the story or whatever was great about it, but I knew that I had room to add a few things, make some tweaks, and do some re-editing. And that usually goes without saying on any film. But at some point, you just have to stop. But, so I'm, you know, we're going through that right now. I'm doing a little bit of tweaking right now. And then hopefully Willie Rowland is literally going to be here in 2 hours. We're going to watch it again, and he's got a voiceover to do, a couple of voiceover pickups. And then we're going to talk about the film and then see where we need to go, and then it's going to be released. But, you know, he, you know, we both produced it together, so he has his ideas and I have my ideas in terms of where we're going to go with the film. I do know that it's not good to wait too long to release a movie, although that's not the case with The Unwilling, so go figure.
Now, does it help you, Sean, to have folks not connected to the film? And we're so close to it, so we can really like it or think it's okay. But someone that doesn't have any, quote, skin in the game, to give you some outside feedback, and that would help you maybe reshape it or look at it in a different way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, usually I really try to find people who are not connected to the film to watch it. And that's not easy to do either, because then, you know, you give it to someone and you tell them, you know, hey, you know, tell me what you think, and they don't watch it for 2 weeks, and maybe they watch half of it and they don't finish it, and so then, you know, there's those things that happen. I just lost my train of thought.
Outside folks watching it.
Yeah. But that's always a healthy thing to do. Oh, okay. So a lot of times these people will say, you know, when you give somebody a movie and you ask them to make, you know, comments on the current cut, you know, there's people out there that can actually watch a film and say, wow, you know, I expected when he said this for, you know, Willie to look that way at that guy. It's like, okay, wow, that's actually a good idea, because I need to see that guy when Willie says that. That's a good note, because that's something I could fix. More often than not, I'll get somebody that says, I wish I could have seen the car driving through the snow. Well, we can't do that.
Right. There's no footage of it.
So, put in. Do you have any other notes?
Yeah.
Is there somebody you want me to, you want, you know, David Lewis to look at? You want David Lewis to have a drink?
Something that's realistic to do.
Yeah. I have one friend who's a filmmaker. We watch each other's movies. And he's great because he understands. He goes, okay, I know what Sean is looking for. And a prime example is when we did Whiskey Slide, and it was a bank robbery. And they were taking the bank president hostage, and they were taking the gold from the main character. Well, in the story, the bank president was the father-in-law to the guy who had the gold. And my buddy says, oh, you know, when that shot happened right there, I really wanted the son to look at his father-in-law, and I wanted them to make eye contact. And I don't ever remember shooting that. In other words, that wasn't written. But in editing, I went back and I looked at certain footage, and I saw that Jordy Protus had looked this way and was staring at his father-in-law, and I saw a different shot where his father-in-law was actually staring this way. Whether or not they were looking at each other or not is irrelevant. The fact is that I made them looking at each other, and it was huge.
Are there things that you've shot that surprised you, where you went in, you didn't have a game plan? Hey, I didn't plan on getting this pigeon to fall out of the sky or something, whatever it is, and you caught it accidentally, and it turned out to be something terrific that you used in a film.
That actually happens so often. I remember M. Night Shyamalan talking. You're familiar with M. Night Shyamalan?
Oh, yeah.
He directed Signs, Unbreakable, stuff like that.
Sixth Sense.
I saw him in a behind. Yeah. He storyboards everything. I mean, he's able to flip through storyboards and say, okay, there's the movie right there. It's on paper. I'm thinking, oh, my God, that would be really, really difficult to do. When you don't have no money, you can't do that. How are you going to get that? So no low budgets movies actually depend on exactly what you just said. It's knowing that when you go out, you get the best of the best, whether it's written or not. So many of my movies don't even look anything like the scripts, the original scripts. You could read the original script from The Unwilling, and you'd go, wow, I see certain scenes, but this is a completely different movie. But I don't need to report to Warner Brothers, so who cares? If Warner Brothers hired me to shoot that script and it didn't look anything like it, I'd be fired.
So you go back to the studio or the, you know, your editing booth and go through the stuff and you just say, oh my God, I can't believe we got this, this, and this. This is perfect.
Right. Well, the beginning of The Unwilling, originally Kai, remember the guy who got shot at the end of the movie, he's looking up at the trees?
Yes.
In the original script, he was floating in a dinghy in a lake, bloody. And the audience is thinking, okay, why is this guy bloody in a dinghy in a lake? And for you to figure out why is you have to watch the movie, and then it's going to come full circle. But it just turns out it was a different movie. And then the alternative ending in The Unwilling, which is the one you did not see, is that Kai was with Tony, the guy that he was always arguing with. And he says, why are you always like a screw up? At the end of one of the versions, an alternative ending, is they were in a car under an overpass by the railroad tracks in downtown San Jose. Kai gets out of the car and says, I'm done. You know, I'm moving on, which he did in the cut that you saw, but this is a different location. He starts to get out and walk away, and all of a sudden there's a shot fired, and all of a sudden Kai stops, and blood, real blood, rolls down his forehead, and he's been shot. And you're thinking, oh, Tony just shot him from behind. All of a sudden the camera turns around, and the daughter shot him because she was hiding in the back of the car, like she did that night when he buried the bodies. But I didn't like that ending because for a number of different reasons, because I want, so the movie that you saw was closest to the original script. So it's madness, this movie making.
You still have a lot of energy. How long do you want to do this for?
Oh, quite as long as I can. I love it. If I'm not sitting here, you know, editing a project or uploading a video or editing a commercial project, to take a break, I go into the living room to my chair, I turn on the movies, and I flip through movies, and I say, okay, I'm going to watch a movie. And I'll find myself for an hour flipping through movies that I'd like to watch, and I never find a movie. But when I look at posters and I read synopsises, your brain is thinking, oh, what's my next idea? And a lot of times I'll leave that chair, and I did this morning. I started to watch a movie first thing this morning, 7 o'clock this morning, got up, started drinking my coffee, and I was watching this movie, and there was this bar scene. And it reminded me of a childhood movie that I always wanted to write about myself. And I wrote 3 pages of this real life story that happened to me with my stepfather, who was always in a bar. And I'm going to make a short film, and my son is going to play that character. So it's not my life story or anything, but it's a movie based on events. And all that came from me flipping through Turner Classic Movies and, okay, what am I going to watch? And then that halted, and I came in here and wrote 3 pages this morning. And I have not written since Jimi Kendrick.
How cathartic is it for you to write something that really reflects how you feel or a part of your life and to have it come out in film? Is it cleansing? Is it therapeutic? What kind of rush do you get out of that?
Sometimes I make movies for all the wrong reasons, because I want to get back at people.
Any girls come to mind?
No, what it is, you know, Consequences of Violence. The reason why that movie was made is because I got sick of hearing about so many drive-by shootings. People just shooting people. And I thought, what the hell is that? I said, what if some guy fired his weapon and he shot the car next to him and it was his fifth grade teacher? And he didn't know it. And he found out later that he killed his fifth grade teacher. How would he feel? So Consequences of Violence is about that. It's about this kid who went to prison for shooting his dad. He gets out of prison, tries to turn his life around, but with peer pressure, he has these friends that are dealing guns, and they con him into dealing guns, and then he ends up doing a drive-by shooting, accidentally shoots his brother. And his brother in the movie is the only person that stood by his side after he got out of prison. So that's a good story. It's a good movie. But that, for me, that movie is it's like a revenge. It's like revenge to all the people out there that do those types of things. And I'm not sure I should actually do stuff like that, because I'm making the movie for all the wrong reason. So I'm on the fence with that.
You didn't feel some kind of satisfaction when you were done with that?
No, because when you have an idea, you have the seed of an idea, and then it goes to paper, and then it turns into something else. And then if you're not careful, it's like, you know, here's a Coke, this Coke, Coca-Cola, a bottle of Coke, it's an idea. It's a seed of an idea. It's a really, really good idea. And then you put it on the table and you accidentally knock it over, and then suddenly the Coke starts to go all over the place. And you can't clean it up, and it's all sticky, and you got to, like, clean it up. That's what a movie is. You know, you go from seed to script, and once you start producing that script, it's a Coca-Cola, a sticky Coca-Cola that goes everywhere. And it's up to me to make sure that it doesn't, you know, roll and drip off the table onto the floor. I got to sort of keep it in line. And then when you edit, you're further trying to keep this thing, you know, contained. And it's just, it consumes your life.
Well, I've seen what it did to you with the project we worked on. What advice would you give to a young filmmaker, someone wanting to do what you do?
Wow. Be ready to starve for a long time.
I bet.
It's not an easy thing, whether you're a musician or an actor or a painter or a filmmaker. You know, if that's something that you really want to do because that's really what you enjoy, too many people do it for the wrong reasons. Too many people do it because they want to be rich, or they want to be famous, or they want attention. Those are all the wrong reasons. Because at 55, I know a lot of people over the years that no longer do it because they were in it for all the wrong reasons. And all I could say is, if you're truly passionate, and I know a lot of passionate people out there who've been doing it for a long time, and they do it for all the right reasons. So if you're not truly passionate about it, it's best just to go study somewhere for 2 years and get a job that's going to pay you $100,000 a year so that you can at least take care of your family.
Well, you've been in it for the long haul, so props to you. Any ideas on what you might do next other than the thing with your son?
You know, I never knew my dad growing up. And so when I was 45, I actually got to meet my dad, finally. I was born in Los Angeles, and I moved to San Jose when I was 4 years old. So for all those years, I thought, he's got to be in Los Angeles. So whenever I was there, I'd look through the phone book. I'd try to find him. But I'm thinking, man, that guy could be in Montana or Hawaii or New York or wherever. He could be anywhere. 45 years, you know, where is this guy? So I finally find out that when I find him when I'm 45 years old, he's in Orange County. I put an ad on a forum, like genealogy forum. I said, hey, I'm looking for my dad. His name could be Flanagan. His name could be Whitman. His name could be Crickon. His name could be Thrasher. Because those are all the potential names that I had heard. So I had the sister I didn't know about. She goes, oh, that's my last name. So she calls me, find out that she's my sister. I go down to see my dad. I'm taking my son with me. You know, Sean Michael Flanagan. Michael's named after my dad that I never knew. So we drive down to Los Angeles, and I filmed this. I filmed the event, the whole trip down Highway 5. My son filmed me talking to my dad at his bedside. He had a stroke, so he couldn't talk. So I didn't know what he knew of me. I showed him some pictures. He got teary-eyed, but he was still trying to figure out what was happening. I thought that I was going to edit that, David, 2 weeks later. I've never touched that footage. 45, that was 10 years ago. I've not touched that footage. And I'm glad I waited, similar to the unwilling. I'm glad I waited because now that little video that I'm doing is now a much broader documentary. It's going to talk about a lot of things. Me growing up without a dad, how filmmaking was a part of my growth, you know, all that kind of stuff.
When you are a single parent and you grow up without a dad, and people go two ways, either kind of continue and behave like your parent would be, or if there was alcoholism or whatever, or you want to change it and be completely different and go over the top. So how did not having a dad shape you as a parent, being a single dad yourself?
I think that was huge. You know, growing up, I really didn't realize that I didn't have a dad because he was never there. But I thank God for sports because I was able to sort of stay preoccupied. And then again, Rocky III, lights out. It changed everything. So I was really laser focused. But when my son was born, you know, my son is everything to me, and that's all I could say is it was very, very important for me to be with him always.
Yeah. So you realized at some point what it meant that you didn't have that, and you wanted to fill some hole for your son, not make him experience the same thing that you did.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it goes way beyond that. There's, you know, my mother, she's a very loving person, but she always tried to find a guy that was going to be the right guy. And she never found the right guy. And that was detrimental to my sister and I, because her life was more about her and whoever the guy was going to be. And so my sister and I sort of, fell wayside. A lot of people look at me today and they say, Sean, I can't believe that you're not an alcoholic or hooked on drugs because of that experience back then. But again, I think that somebody, movies and sports and weightlifting and nutrition is everything. It's the foundation of who I am in the movies that I make. So that's it.
Well, you're going to be the same as your parents, or you're going to break the cycle.
It's a new life.
Yeah. Hey, it's a good life, man. It's a good life.
Right. No, it is. You know, when we were filming Jimi Kendrick, I mean, I hope that I don't have, I hope on the next film I can go out and just direct and have like two or three other people setting up the shot so I could talk to my actors. Because when we make a film like Jimi Kendrick, when I'm trying to, move the light and keep it quiet and make sure that you guys are fed and make sure that there's water, and I'm trying to, set up the camera, I'm trying to do all these things and while dealing with my current physical situation with my back, for example, that's not fun. I like to be on a set where somebody is, dealing with the camera, so that way I can spend more time with you guys. And poor Susie, I'm literally, okay, stand right there. Okay, look over there. Okay, now I'm doing, it's like literally, it's like direction on the spot. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's the best because it leaves you guys trying to figure out what the heck is going on, but that shows in your character, and so that works. But that being said, with this type of film, it's good to have some rehearsals or pre-production meetings or, just a chance for me to answer any questions that you guys might have. But, so I hope hopefully there we'll get more of that.
Yeah. No, I look forward to working on something else with you because you do great work. It makes for a great demo reel. It makes for a great product for the audience too. So credit to you for doing this for a long time and doing it at such a high level.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Sean, we'll do it again, man. You're the best.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Check out Sean's work, The Unwilling, on Amazon Prime, and be on the lookout for Jimi Kendrick coming soon near you. Thank you so much for listening today. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Give us a little thumbs up, nice review. Certainly helps out a lot down the line. You can follow me on Dave Lewis Sports. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. We'll be right back.